shoving my way in after him with some difficulty, I found him seated on the flat stone edging of a small pool. A weathered block of stone stood askew behind him, with a dim and vaguely human figure etched in the stained surface. It must be a saint's pool, I realized. These small shrines to one saint or another dotted the highlands, and were often to be found in such secluded spots, though even up here tattered remnants of fabric flapped from the branches of a rowan tree that overhung the water, pledges from visitors who petitioned the saint for health, or a safe journey, perhaps. Dougal greeted my appearance with a nod. He crossed himself, bent his head, and scooped up a double handful of water. The water had an odd dark colour and a worse smell. Likely a sulphur spring, I thought. The day was hot and I was thirsty, though, so I followed Dougal's example. The water was faintly bitter, but cold and not unpalatable. I drank some, then splashed my face. The road had been dusty. I looked up, face dripping, to find him watching me with a very odd expression. Something between curiosity and calculation, I thought. "Bit of a climb for a drink, isn't it?" I asked lightly. There were water bottles on the horses, and I doubted that Dougal meant to petition the patron of the spring for our safe journey back to the inn. He struck me as a believer in more worldly methods. "How well do you know the captain?" he asked abruptly. "Less well than you," I snapped back. "I've met him once before today, and that by accident." We didn't get on. Surprisingly, the stern face lightened a bit.
"Well," he admitted, "I canna say as I care for the man much myself."
He drummed his fingers on the well-coping, considering something.
"He's well thought of by some, though," he said, eyeing me. "A brave soldier and a bonny fighter, by what I hear."
I raised my eyebrows. Not being an English general, I'm not impressed. He laughed, showing startlingly white teeth. The sound disturbed three rooks in the tree overhead who flapped off, full of hoarse complaint.
"Are you a spy for the English or the French?"
he asked, with another bewildering change of subject. At least he was being direct, for a change. "Certainly not," I said crossly. "I'm plain Claire Beecham, and nothing more." I soaked my handkerchief in the water and used it to wipe my neck. Small, refreshing trickles ran down my back under the grey serge of my travelling gown. I pressed the wet cloth to my bosom and squeezed, producing a similar effect. Dougal was silent for several minutes, watching me intently as I conducted my haphazard ablutions.
"You've seen Jimmy's back," he said suddenly.
"I could hardly help doing so," I said a little coldly. I'd given up wondering what he was up to with these disconnected questions. Presumably he would tell me when he was ready.
"You mean, did I know Randall did it, then? Or did you know that yourself?"
I kent it well enough," he answered, calmly appraising me. "But I wasn't aware that you did."
I shrugged, implying that what I knew and what I didn't were hardly his concern.
"I was there, you ken," he said casually.
"Where?"
"At Fort William. I had a bit of business there with the garrison. The clerk there knew Jimmy was some kin to me and sent me word when they arrested him, so I went along to see what aught could be done for him."
"Apparently you weren't very successful," I said, with an edge.
Dougal shrugged.
"Unfortunately not. Had it been the regular sergeant-major in charge, I might have saved Jimmy at least the second go-round. But as it was, Randall was new in command. He didn't know me and was indisposed to listen much to what I said. I thought at the time it was only he meant to make an example of Jimmy, to show everyone at the start that there'd be no softness from him."
He tapped the short sword he wore at his belt.
"It's a sound enough principle when you're in command of men. Earn their respect before you do aught else, and if you canna do that, earn their fear."
I remembered the expression on the face of Randall's corporal, and thought I knew which route the captain had taken. Dougal's deep-set eyes were on my face, interested.
"You knew it was Randall. Did Jimmy tell you about it?"
"A bit," I said cautiously. "He must think well of you," he said musingly. "He doesn't generally speak of it to anyone."
"I can't imagine why not," I said, provoked. I still held my breath each time we came to a new tavern or inn, until it was clear that the company had settled for an evening of drinking and gossip by the fire. Dougal smiled sardonically, clearly knowing what was in my mind.
"Well, it wasn't necessary to tell me, was it, since I kent it already?"
He swished a hand idly through the strange dark water, stirring up brimstone fumes.
"I'd not know how it goes in Oxfordshire," he said, with a sarcastic emphasis that made me squirm slightly. "But hereabouts, ladies are not generally exposed to such sights as floggings. Have you ever seen one?"
"No, nor do I much want to," I responded sharply. "I can imagine what it would take to make marks like the ones on Jamie's back, though." Dougal shook his head, flipping water out of the pool at a curious jay that ventured close.
"Now, there you're wrong, lass, and you'll pardon my saying so. Imagination is all very well, but it isn't equal to the sight of a man having his back laid open. A very nasty thing. It's meant to break a man, and most often it succeeds."
"Not with Jamie." I spoke more sharply than I had intended. Jamie was my patient, and to some extent my friend as well. I had no wish to discuss his personal history with Dougal, though I would, if pressed, admit to a certain morbid curiosity. I had never met anyone more open and at the same time more mysterious than the tall young Tavish. Dougal laughed shortly and wiped his wet hand through his hair, pasting back the strands that had escaped during our flight, for so I thought of it, from the tavern.
"Well, Jamie's as stubborn as the rest of his family. Like rocks, the lot of them, and he's the worst."
But there was a definite tone of respect in his voice, grudging though it was.
"Jamie told you he was flogged for escape?"
"Yes."
"Aye. He went over the wall of the camp just after dark, same day as the dragoons brought him in. That was a fairly frequent occurrence there, the prisoners' accommodations not being as secure as might be wished. So the English ran patrols near the walls every night. The garrison clerk told me Jamie put up a good fight from the look of him when he came back, but it was 6 against 1, and the 6 all we muskets, so it didn't last long. Jamie spent the night in chains, and went to the whipping post first thing in the morning."
He paused, checking me for signs of faintness or nausea, I supposed.
"Floggings were done right after assembly, so as to start everyone off in the proper frame of mind for the day. There were 3 to be flogged that day, and Jamie was the last of them."
"You actually saw it?"
"Oh, aye. And I'll tell you, lass, watching men being flogged is not pleasant. I've had the good fortune never to experience it, but I expect being flogged is no very pleasant either. Watching it happen to someone else while waiting for it yourself is probably least pleasant of all."
"I don't doubt it," I murmured.
Dougal nodded. "Jamie looked grim enough, but he didn't turn a hair, even listening to the screams and the other noises. Did you know you can hear the flesh being torn?"
"Oh."
"So I thought myself, lass," he said, grimacing in memory of it. "To say nothing of the blood and bruises. Ech."
He spat, carefully avoiding the pool and its coping.
"Turned my stomach to see, and I'm no a squeamish man by any means."
Dougal went on with his ghastly story.
"Come Jamie's turn. He walks up to the post. Some men have to be dragged, but not him. And holds out his hand so the corporal can unlock the manacles he's wearing. The corporal goes to pull his arm, like, to haul him into place. But Jamie shakes him off and steps back a piece. Was half expecting him to make a dash for it, but instead he just pulls off his shirt. It's torn here and there and filthy as a clout. But he folds it up careful, like it was his Sunday best, and leaves it on the ground. Then he walks over to the post, steady as a soldier, and puts his hands up to be bound."
Dougal shook his head, marvelling. The sunlight filtering through the rowan trees dappled him with lace shadows, so he looked like a man seen through a doily.
I smiled at the thought,
and he nodded approvingly at me, thinking my response due to his story.
Aye, lass, courage like that is uncommon rare. It wasn't ignorance, mind. He'd just seen two men flogged, and he knew the same was coming to him. It's just he'd made up his mind there was no help for it. Boldness in battle is nothing out of the way for a Scotsman, you ken. But to face down fear in cold blood is rare in any man.
He was but 19 at the time, Dougal added as an afterthought.
Must have been rather gruesome to watch, I said ironically. I wonder you weren't sick.
Dougal saw the irony and let it lie.
I nearly was, lass, he said, lifting his dark brows. The first lash drew blood, and the lad's back was half red and half blue within a minute. He didn't scream, though, or beg for mercy, or twist round to try and save himself. He just set his forehead hard against the post and stood there. He flinched when the lash hit, of course, but nothing more.
I doubt I could do that, he admitted.
Nor are there many that could.
He fainted half through it, and they roused him with water from a jug and finished it.
Very nasty indeed, I observed. Why are you telling me about it?
I haven't finished telling you about it.
Dougal pulled the dirk from his belt and began to clean his fingernails with the point. He was a fastidious man, in spite of the difficulties of keeping clean on the road.
Jamie was slumped in the ropes with the blood running down and staining his kilt. I didn't think he'd fainted. He was just too wambly to stand for the moment. But just then Captain Randall came down into the yard. I don't know why he'd not been there to begin with. Had business that delayed him, perhaps. Anyway, Jamie saw him coming and had the presence of mind left to close his eyes and let his head flop, like as if he were unconscious.
Dougal knitted his brows, concentrating fiercely on a recalcitrant hangnail.
The captain was fair put out that they'd flogged Jamie already. Seems that was a pleasure he'd meant to have for himself. Still, not much to be done about it at the moment. But then he thought to make inquiries about how Jamie came to escape in the first place.
He held up the dirk, examining it for nicks, then began to sharpen the edge against the stone he sat on.
Had several soldiers shaking in their boots before he was done. A man's a wee wi' words. I'll see that for him.
That he has, I said dryly. The dirk scraped rhythmically against the stone. Every so often a faint spark leapt from the metal as it struck a rough patch in the rock.
Well, in the course of this inquiry it came out that Jamie had the heel of a loaf and a bit of cheese with him when they got him, taking it along when he went over the wall. Whereupon the captain thinks for a moment, then smiles a smile I should hate to see on my grandmother's face. He declares that theft being a serious offence, the penalty should be commensurate, and sentences Jamie on the spot to another 100 lashes.
I flinched in spite of myself. That would kill him.
Dougal nodded.
Aye, that's what the garrison doctor said. He said as he'd permit no such thing. In good conscience, the prisoner must be allowed a week to heal before receiving the second flogging.
Well, how humanitarian of him, I said.
Good conscience, my Aunt Fanny.
And what did Captain Randall think of this?
He was none too pleased at first, but he reconciled himself. Once he did, the sergeant major, who knew a real faint when he saw one, had Jamie untied. The lad staggered a bit, but he kept to his feet, and a few of the men there cheered, which didn't go over a treat with the captain. He wasn't best pleased when the sergeant picked up Jamie's shirt and handed it back to the lad either, though it was quite a popular move with the men.
Dougal twisted the blade back and forth, examining it critically. Then he laid it across his knee and gave me a direct look.
You know, lass, it's fairly easy to be brave sitting in a warm tavern over a glass of ale. 'Tis not so easy squatting in a cold field with musket balls going past your head and heather tickling your arse. And still less easy when you're standing face to face with your enemy, with your own blood running down your legs.
I wouldn't suppose so, I said. I did feel a little faint, in spite of everything. I plunged both hands into the water, letting the dark liquid chill my wrists.
I did go back to see Randall later in the week, Dougal said defensively, as though he felt some need to justify the action. We talked a good bit, and I even offered him compensation.
Oh, I am impressed, I murmured, but desisted in the face of his glare. No, I mean it. It was kind of you. I gather Randall declined your offer, though.
Aye, he did. And I still dinna ken why, for I've not found English officers on the whole to be over-scrupulous when it comes to their purses. And clothes such as the captain's come a bit dear.
Perhaps he has other sources of income, I suggested.
He does, for a fact,
Dougal confirmed, but with a sharp glance at me.
Still,
he hesitated, then proceeded more slowly.
I went back then, to be there for Jamie when he came up again, though there wasn't much I could do for him at that point, poor lad.
The second time, Jamie had been the only prisoner up for flogging. The guards had removed his shirt before bringing him out, just after sun-up on a cold October morning.
I could see the lad was dead scared, said Dougal, though he was walking by himself and wouldn't let the guard touch him. I could see him shaking, as much with the cold as we nerves, and the goose flesh thick on his arms and chest, but the sweat was standing on his face as well. A few minutes later, Randall came out, the whip tucked under his arm and the lead plummets at the tips of the lashes clicking softly together as he walked. He had surveyed Jamie coolly, then motioned to the sergeant-major to turn the prisoner around to show his back.
Dougal grimaced.
Pitiful sight it was, too. Still raw. No more than half-healed, with the wheels turned black and the rest yellow with bruises. The thought of a whip coming down on that soreness was enough to make me blench, along with most of those watching. Randall then turned to the sergeant-major and said, "A pretty job, Sergeant Wilkes. I must see if I can do as well." With considerable punctilio, he then called for the garrison doctor and had him certify officially that Jamie was fit enough to be flogged.
"You seen a cat play wi' a wee moosey?" Dougal asked.
It was like that. Randall strolled round the lad, making one kind of remark and another, none of them which he'd call pleasant. And Jamie stood there like an oak tree, saying nothing and keeping his eyes fixed on the post, not looking at Randall at all. I could see the lad was hugging his elbows to try to stop the shivering, and you could tell Randall saw it too. His mouth tightened up, and he says, "I thought this was the young man who only a week past was shouting that he wasn't afraid to die. Surely a man who's not afraid to die isn't afraid of a few lashes." And he gives Jamie a poke in the belly with the handle of the whip. Jamie met Randall's eye straight on and said, "No, but I'm afraid I'll freeze stiff before you're done talking."
Dougal sighed.
"Well, was a braw speech, but damn reckless for all that. Now, scourging a man is never a pretty business, but there's ways to make it worse than it might be. Striking sideways to cut deep, or stepping in wi' a hard blow ower the kidneys, for instance."
He shook his head.
"Very ugly."
He frowned, choosing his words slowly.
Randall's face was intent, I suppose you'd say, and sort of lighted up, like when a man is looking at a lass he's soft on, if you know what I mean. It was as though we were doing something much worse to Jamie than just skinning him alive. The blood was running down the lad's legs by the 15th stroke, and the tears running down his face with the sweat.
I swayed a little, and put out a hand to the stone of the coping.
"Well," he said abruptly, catching sight of my expression, "I'll see no more except that he lived through it. When the corporal untied his hands, he nearly fell, but the corporal and sergeant major each caught him by an arm and kind of steadied him till he could keep his feet. He was shaking worse than ever from shock and cold, but his head was up, and his eyes blazing. I could see it from 20 feet away. He keeps his eyes fixed on Randall while they help him off the platform, leaving bloody footprints. It's like watching Randall is the only thing keeping him on his feet. Randall's face was almost as white as Jamie's, and his eyes were locked with the lad's, as though either of them would fall down if he took his eyes away. Dougal's own eyes were fixed, still seeing the eerie scene. Everything was quiet in the small glade, except for the faint rush of wind through the leaves of the rowan tree. I closed my eyes and listened to it for some time. "Why?" I asked finally, eyes still closed. "Why did you tell me?" Dougal was watching me intently when I opened my eyes. I dipped a hand in the spring again and applied the cool water to my temples.
"I thought it might serve as what you may call a character illustration."
"Of Randall?" I uttered a short, mirthless laugh. "I don't need any further evidence as to his character, thank you."
"Of Randall," he agreed. "And Jamie, too."
I looked at him, suddenly ill at ease.
"You see, I have orders."
He emphasized the word sarcastically.
"From the good captain."
"Orders to do what?" I asked, the agitated feeling increasing.
"To produce the person of an English subject, one Clare Beecham by name, at Fort William on Monday the 18th of June, for questioning."
I must have looked truly alarming, for he jumped to his feet and came over to me.
"Put your head between your knees, lass," he instructed, pushing on the back of my neck, "till the faintness passes off."
"I know what to do," I said irritably, doing it nonetheless. I closed my eyes, feeling the ebbing blood begin to throb in my temples again. The clammy sensation around my face and ears began to disappear, though my hands were still icy. I concentrated on breathing properly, counting in 1, 2, 3, 4, out 1, 2, in 1, 2, 3, 4. At length I sat up, feeling more or less in possession of all my faculties. Dougal had resumed his seat on the stone coping and was waiting patiently, watching to be sure that I didn't fall backward into the spring.
"There's a way out of it," he said abruptly. "The only one I can see."
"Lead me to it," I said, with an unconvincing attempt at a smile.
"Very well, then."
He sat forward, leaning toward me to explain.
"Randall's the right to take you for questioning because you're a subject of the English crown. Well, then, we must change that."
I stared at him, uncomprehending. "What do you mean?"
"You're a subject of the crown as well, aren't you?
How would you change such a thing?"
"Scots law and English law are very similar," he said, frowning, "but no the same. And an English officer cannot compel the person of a Scot, unless he's firm evidence of a crime committed or grounds for serious suspicions. Even with suspicion, he could no remove a Scottish subject from clan lands without the permission of the laird concerned."
"You've been talking to Ned Gowan," I said, beginning to feel a little dizzy again. He nodded.
"Aye, I have. I thought it might come to this," he came. "And what he told me is what I thought myself. The only way I can legally refuse to give you to Randall is to change you from an Englishwoman into a Scot."
"Into a Scot?" I said,
the dazed feeling quickly being replaced by a horrible suspicion.
This was confirmed by his next words.
"Aye," he said, nodding at my expression. "You must marry a Scot. Young Jamie."
"I couldn't do that."
"Well," he frowned, considering, "I suppose you could take Rupert instead. He's a widower, and he's the lease of a small farm. Still, he's a good bit older, and..."
"I don't want to marry Rupert either. That's the most absurd..." Words failed me. Springing to my feet in agitation, I paced around the small clearing, fallen rowan berries crunching under my feet.
"Jamie's a goodly lad," Dougal argued, still sitting on the coping. "He's not much in the way of property just now, true, but he's a kind-hearted lad. He'd not be cruel to you. And he's a bonny fighter,
with very good reason to hate Randall. Nay, marry him, and he'll fight to his last breath to protect you.
But I can't marry anyone, I burst out. Dougal's eyes were suddenly sharp.
Why not, lass? Do you have a husband living still?
No. It's just... Oh, it's ridiculous. Such things don't happen. Dougal had relaxed when I said no. Now he glanced up at the sun and rose to go.
Best get moving, lass. There are things that we'll have to attend to. There'll have to be a special dispensation, he murmured, as though to himself. But Ned can manage that.
He took my arm, still muttering to himself. I wrenched it away. I will not marry anyone, I said firmly. He seemed undisturbed by this, merely raising his brows.
You want me to take you to Randall?
No! Something occurred to me. So at least you believe me when I say I'm not an English spy.
I do now.
He spoke with some emphasis. Why now, not before? He nodded at the spring and at the worn figure etched in the rock. It must be hundreds of years old, much older even than the giant rowan tree that shaded the spring and cast its white flowers into the black water.
St. Ninian's Spring. You drank the water before I asked you.
I was thoroughly bewildered by this time. What does that have to do with it? He looked surprised, then his mouth twisted in a smile.
You didn't know? They call it the Liar's Spring as well. The water smells of the fumes of hell. Anyone who drinks the water and then tells untruth will hear the gizzard burnt out of him.
I see. I spoke between my teeth. Well, my gizzard is quite intact. So you can believe me when I say I'm not a spy, English or French. And you can believe something else, Dougal Mackenzie. I'm not marrying anyone. He wasn't listening. In fact, he had already pushed his way through the bushes that screened the spring. Only a quivering oak branch marked his passage. Seething, I followed him. I remonstrated at some length further on the ride back to the inn. Dougal advised me finally to save my breath to cool my porridge with, and after that we rode in silence. Reaching the inn, I flung my reins to the ground and stamped upstairs to the refuge of my room. The whole idea was not only outrageous, but unthinkable. I paced around and around the narrow room, feeling increasingly like a rat in a trap. Why in hell hadn't I the nerve to steal away from the Scots earlier, whatever the risk? I sat down on the bed and tried to think calmly. Considered strictly from Dougal's point of view, no doubt the idea had merit. If he refused point-blank to hand me over to Randall with no excuse, the captain might easily try to take me by force. And whether he believed me or not, Dougal might understandably not want to engage in a skirmish with a lot of English dragoons for my sake. And, viewed in cold blood, the idea had some merit from my side as well. If I were married to a Scot, I would presumably no longer be watched and guarded. It would be that much easier to get away when the time came. And if it were Jamie, well, he liked me, clearly. And he knew the Highlands like the backs of his hands. He would perhaps take me to Craignadun, or at least in the general direction. Yes, possibly marriage was the best way to gain my goal. That was the cold-blooded way to look at it. My blood, however, was anything but cold. I was hot with fury and agitation, and couldn't keep still, pacing and fuming, looking for a way out. Anyway. After an hour of this, my face was flushed and my head throbbing. I got up and threw open the shutters, sticking my head out into the cooling breeze. There was a peremptory rap on the door behind me. Dougal entered as I pulled my head in. He bore a sheaf of stiff paper like a salver, and was followed by Rupert and the immaculate Ned Gowan, bringing up the rear like royal equerries. "Please do come in," I said courteously. Ignoring me, as usual, Dougal removed a chamber pot from its resting place on the table and fanned the sheets of paper out ceremoniously on the rough oak surface.
"All done," he said,
with the pride of one who has shepherded a difficult project to a successful conclusion.
"Ned's drawn up the papers. Nothing like a lawyer, so long as he's on your side. Hey, Ned?"
The men all laughed, evidently in good humour.
"Not really difficult, ye ken," Ned said modestly. "It's but a simple contract."
He riffled the pages with a proprietary forefinger, then paused, wrinkling his brow at a sudden thought.
"You've no property in France, have you?"
he asked, peering worriedly at me over the half-spectacles he wore for close work. I shook my head, and he relaxed, shuffling the papers back into a pile and tapping the edges neatly together.
"That's that, then. You'll only need to sign here at the foot, and Dougal and Rupert to witness."
The lawyer set down the inkpot he had brought in, and whipping a clean quill from his pocket, presented it ceremoniously to me.
"And just what is this?" I asked.
This was in the nature of a rhetorical question, for the top page of the bundle said, "Contract of Marriage," in a clear calligraphic hand, the letters 2 inches high and starkly black across the page. Dougal suppressed a sigh of impatience at my recalcitrance.
"You ken quite weel what it is," he said shortly, "and unless you've had another bright thought for keeping yourself out of Randall's hands, you'll sign it and have done with it. Time's short."
Bright thoughts were in particularly short supply at the moment, despite the hour I had spent hammering away at the problem. It really began to seem that this incredible alternative was the best I could do, struggle as I might.
"But I don't want to marry," I said stubbornly.
It occurred to me as well that mine wasn't the only point of view involved. I remembered the girl with blonde hair I had seen kissing Jamie in the alcove at the castle.
"And maybe Jamie doesn't want to marry me," I said. "What about that?"
Dougal dismissed this as unimportant. "Jamie's a soldier. He'll do as he's told." "So will you," he said pointedly. "Unless, of course, you'd prefer an English prison."
I glared at him, breathing heavily. I had been in a stir ever since our abrupt removal from Randall's office, and my level of agitation had now increased substantially, confronted with the choice in black and white, as it were.
"I want to talk to him," I said abruptly.
Dougal's eyebrows shot up.
"Jamie? Why?"
"Why?
Because you're forcing me to marry him, and so far as I can see, you haven't even told him." Plainly, this was an irrelevancy as far as Dougal was concerned, but he eventually gave in, and, accompanied by his minions, went to fetch Jamie from the tap room below. Jamie appeared shortly, looking understandably bewildered.
"Did you know that Dougal wants us to marry?" I demanded bluntly.
His expression cleared.
"Ooh, I knew that."
"But surely," I said, "a young man like yourself. I mean, isn't there anyone else you're, interested in?"
He looked blank for a moment, then understanding dawned.
"Oh, am I promised? Nee, I'm not much of a prospect for a girl."
He hurried on, as though feeling this might sound insulting.
"I mean, I've no property to speak of, and nothing more than a soldier's pay to live on."
He rubbed his chin, eyeing me dubiously.
"Then there's the minor difficulty that I've a price on my head. No father much wants his daughter married to a man as may be arrested and hanged any time. Did you think of that?"
I flapped my hand, dismissing the matter of outlawry as a minor consideration compared to the whole monstrous idea. I had one last try. "Does it bother you that I'm not a virgin?" He hesitated a moment before answering.
"Well, no," he said slowly. "So long as it doesn't bother you that I am."
He grinned at my drop-jawed expression and backed toward the door.
"Reckon one of us should know what they're doing," he said.
The door closed softly behind him. Clearly, the courtship was over. The papers duly signed, I made my way cautiously down the inn's steep stairs and over to the bar table in the tap room. "Whiskey," I said to the rumpled old creature behind it. He glared roomily, but a nod from Dougal made him oblige with a bottle and glass. The latter was thick and greenish, a bit smeared, with a chip out of the rim, but it had a hole in the top, and that was all that mattered at the moment. Once the searing effect of swallowing the stuff had passed, it did induce a certain spurious calmness. I felt detached, noticing details of my surroundings with a peculiar intensity. The small stained-glass inset over the bar, casting coloured shadows over the ruffianly proprietor and his wares. The curve of the handle on a copper-bottomed dipper that hung on the wall next to me. A green-bellied fly struggling on the edges of a sticky puddle on the table. With a certain amount of fellow feeling, I nudged it out of danger with the edge of my glass. I gradually became aware of raised voices behind the closed door on the far side of the room. Dougal had disappeared there after the conclusion of his business with me, presumably to firm up arrangements with the other contracting party. I was pleased to hear that, judging from the sound of it, my intended bridegroom was cutting up rough, despite his apparent lack of objection earlier. Perhaps he hadn't wanted to offend me. "Stick to it, lad," I murmured, and took another gulp. Some time later, I was dimly conscious of a hand prying my fingers open in order to remove the greenish glass. Another hand was steadyingly under my elbow. "Christ, she's drunk as an old bism in a body," said a voice in my ear. The voice rasped unpleasantly, I thought, as though its owner had been eating sandpaper. I giggled softly at the thought. "Quiet yourself, woman," said the unpleasant, rasping voice. It grew fainter as the owner turned to talk to someone else. "Drunk as a laird and screeching like a parrot. What'd you expect?" Another voice interrupted the first. I couldn't tell what it said. The words were blurred and indistinguishable. It was a pleasant sound, though, deep and somehow reassuring. It came nearer, and I could make out a few words. I made an effort to focus, but my attention had begun to wander again. The fly had found its way back to the puddle and was floundering in the middle, hopelessly mired. The light from the stained-glass window fell on it, glittering like sparks on the straining green belly. My gaze fixed on the tiny green spot, which seemed to pulsate as the fly twitched and struggled. "Brother, you haven't a chance," I said. And the spark went out. Chapter 14. A marriage takes place. There was a low-beamed ceiling over me when I woke, and a thick quilt tucked tidily under my chin. I seemed to be clad only in my shift. I started to sit up to look for my clothes, but thought better of it halfway up. I eased myself very carefully back down, closed my eyes, and held on to my head to prevent it from rolling off the pillow and bouncing on the floor. I woke again, sometime later, when the door of the room opened. I cracked one eye cautiously. A wavering outline resolved itself into the dour figure of Murta, staring disapprovingly down at me from the foot of the bed. I closed the eye. I heard a muffled Scottish noise, presumably indicating appalled disgust. But when I looked again, he was gone. I was just sinking thankfully back into unconsciousness when the door opened again, this time to reveal a middle-aged woman I took to be the publican's wife, carrying a ewer and basin. She bustled cheerily into the room and banged the shutters open with a crash that reverberated through my head like a tank collision. Advancing on the bed like a panzer division, she ripped the quilt from my feeble grasp and tossed it aside, leaving me quaking and exposed. "Come along then, my love," she said. "We mun get you ready now." She put a hefty forearm behind my shoulders and levered me into a sitting position. I clutched my head with one hand, my stomach with the other. "Ready?" I said, through a mouth filled with decayed moss. The woman began briskly washing my face.
"Och, aye," she said. "You dinna want to miss your own wedding now, do you?"
"Yes," I said, but was ignored as she unceremoniously stripped off my shift and stood me in the middle of the floor for further intimate attentions. A bit later, I sat on the bed, fully dressed, feeling dazed and belligerent, but thanks to a glass of port supplied by the goodwife, at least functional. I sipped carefully at a second glass as the woman tugged a comb through the thickets of my hair. I jumped and shuddered, spilling the port, as the door crashed open once more. One damn thing after another, I thought balefully. This time it was a double visitation. Murta and Ned Gowan, wearing similar looks of disapprobation. I exchanged glares with Ned while Murta came into the room and walked slowly round the bed, surveying me from every angle. He returned to Ned and muttered something in a tone too low for me to hear. With a final glance of despair in my direction, he pulled the door shut behind them. At last my hair was dressed to the woman's satisfaction, swept back and pulled high in a knot at the crown, curls picked loose to tumble to the back, and ringlets in front of my ears. It felt as though my scalp were going to pop off from the tension of the strained back hair, but the effect in the looking-glass the woman provided was undeniably becoming. I began to feel slightly more human, and even brought myself to thank her for her efforts. She left me the looking-glass and departed, remarking that it was so lucky to be married in summer, wasn't it, as I'd have plenty of flowers for my hair.
"We who are about to die," I said to my reflection, sketching a salute in the glass.
I collapsed on the bed, plastered a wet cloth over my face, and went back to sleep. I was having a rather nice dream, something to do with grassy fields and wildflowers, when I became aware that what I had thought a playful breeze tugging at my sleeves was a pair of none too gentle hands. I sat up with a jerk, blindly flailing. When I got my eyes open, I saw that my small chamber now resembled a tube station with faces wall to wall. Ned Gowan, Murta, the innkeeper, the innkeeper's wife, and a lanky young man who turned out to be the innkeeper's son, with his arms full of assorted flowers, which accounted for the scents in my dream. There was also a young woman, armed with a round wicker basket, who smiled amiably at me, displaying the lack of several rather important teeth. This person, it developed, was the village sempstress, recruited to repair the deficiencies of my wardrobe by adjusting the fit of a dress, obtained on short notice from some local connection of the innkeeper's. Ned was carrying the dress in question, hanging from one hand like a dead animal. Smoothed out on the bed, it proved to be a low-necked gown of heavy cream-coloured satin, with a separate bodice that buttoned with dozens of tiny cloth-covered buttons, each embroidered with a gold fleur-de-lis. The neckline and the belled sleeves were heavily ruched with lace, as was the embroidered overskirt of chocolate-brown velvet. The innkeeper was half buried in the petticoats he carried, his bristling whiskers barely visible over the foamy layers. I looked at the port wine stain on my grey serge skirt, and vanity won out. If I were in fact to be married, I didn't want to do it looking like the village drudge. After a short spell of frenetic activity, with me standing like a dressmaker's dummy, and everyone else racing about, fetching, carrying, criticising, and tripping over each other, the final product was ready, complete to white asters and yellow roses pinned in my hair, and a heart pounding madly away beneath the lacy bodice. The fit wasn't quite perfect, and the gown smelled rather strongly of its previous owner, but the satin was weighty and swished rather fascinatingly about my feet, over the layers of petticoats. I felt quite regal, and not a little lovely.
"You can't make me do this, you know," I hissed threateningly at Murta's back as I followed him downstairs.
But he and I both knew my words were empty bravado. If I had ever had the strength of character to defy Dougal and take my chances with the English, it had drained away with the whisky. Dougal, Ned, and the rest were in the main taproom at the floor of the stairs, drinking and exchanging pleasantries with a few villagers who seemed to have nothing better to do with their afternoon than hang about getting sloshed. Dougal caught sight of me slowly descending, and abruptly stopped talking. The others fell silent as well, and I floated down in a most gratifying cloud of reverent admiration. Dougal's deep-set eyes covered me slowly from head to foot, and returned to my face with a complete ungrudging nod of acknowledgement. What with one thing and another, it was some time since a man had looked at me that way, and I nodded quite graciously back. After the first silence, the rest of those in the tap-room became vocal in their admiration, and even Murta allowed himself a small smile, nodding in satisfaction at the results of his efforts. "And who appointed you fashion editor?" I thought disagreeably. Still, I had to admit that he was responsible for my not marrying in Grey Serge. Marrying. Oh, God. Buoyed temporarily by port wine and cream lace, I had momentarily managed to ignore the significance of the occasion. I gripped the banister as fresh realization hit like a blow in the stomach. Looking over the throng, though, I noticed one glaring omission. My groom was nowhere in sight. Heartened by the thought that he might have succeeded in escaping out of a window and be miles away by now, I accepted a parting cup of wine from the innkeeper before following Dougal outside. Ned and Rupert went to fetch the horses. Murta had disappeared somewhere, perhaps to search for traces of Jamie. Dougal held me by one arm, ostensibly to support me lest I stumble in my satin slippers, in reality to prevent any last-minute breaks for freedom. It was a warm Scottish day, meaning that the mist wasn't quite heavy enough to qualify as a drizzle, but not far off either. Suddenly the inn door opened, and the sun came out in the person of James. If I were a radiant bride, the groom was positively resplendent. My mouth fell open and stayed that way. A Highlander in full regalia is an impressive sight. Any Highlander, no matter how old, ill-favoured or crabbed in appearance. A tall, straight-bodied and by no means ill-favoured young Highlander at close range is breathtaking. The thick red-gold hair had been brushed to a smooth gleam that swept the collar of a fine lawn shirt with tucked front, belled sleeves, and lace-trimmed wrist frills that matched the cascade of the starched jabot at the throat, decorated with a ruby stickpin. His tartan was a brilliant crimson and black that blazed among the more sedate Mackenzies in their green and white. The flaming wool, fastened by a circular silver brooch, fell from his right shoulder in a graceful drape, caught by a silver-studded sword belt before continuing its sweep past neat calves, clothed in woolen hose, and stopping just short of the silver-buckled black leather boots. Sword, dirk, and badger-skin sporran completed the ensemble. Well over 6 feet tall, broad in proportion, and striking of feature, he was a far cry from the grubby horse-handler I was accustomed to, and he knew it. Making a leg in courtly fashion, he swept me a bow of impeccable grace, murmuring, "Your servant, ma'am," eyes glinting with mischief. "Oh," I said faintly. I had seldom seen the taciturn Dougal at a loss for words before. Thick brows knotted over a suffused face. He seemed in his way as taken aback by this apparition as I was.
"Are you mad, man?" he said at last. "What if someone's to see you?"
Jamie cocked a sardonic eyebrow at the older man.
"Why, uncle," he said, "insults, and on my wedding day too. You wouldn't have me shame my wife now, would you? Besides," he added with a malicious gleam, "I hardly think it would be legal did I not marry in my own name. And you do want it legal now, don't you?"
With an apparent effort, Dougal recovered his self-possession.
"If you're quite finished, Jamie, we'll get on with it," he said.
But Jamie wasn't quite finished, it seemed. Ignoring Dougal's fuming, he drew out a short string of white beads from his sporran. He stepped forward and fastened the necklace around my neck. Looking down, I could see it was a string of small Baroque pearls, those irregularly shaped productions of freshwater mussels, interspersed with tiny, pierced-work gold rondelles. Smaller pearls dangled from the gold beads.
"They're only Scotch pearls," he said, apologetically. "But they look bonny on you."
His fingers lingered a moment on my neck.
"Those were your mother's pearls," said Dougal,
glowering at the necklace.
"Aye," said Jamie calmly. "And now they're my wife's. Shall we go?"
Wherever we were going, it was some distance from the village. We made a rather morose wedding party, the bridal pair encircled by the others like convicts being escorted towards some distant prison. The only conversation was a muted apology from Jamie for being late, explaining that there had been some difficulty in finding a clean shirt and coat large enough to fit him.
"I think this one belongs to the local squire's son," he said, flipping the lacy jabot. "Bit of a dandy, it looks like."
We dismounted and left the horses at the foot of a small hill. A footpath led upward through the heather.
"You've made the arrangements?"
I heard Dougal say in an undertone to Rupert as they tethered the beasts.
"Och, aye."
There was a flash of teeth in the black beard.
"It was a bit of trouble to persuade the padre, but we showed him the special license."
He patted his sporran, which clinked musically, giving me some idea of the nature of the special license. Through the drizzle and mist, I saw the chapel jutting out of the heather. With a sense of complete disbelief, I saw the round-shouldered roof and the odd little many-paned windows, which I had last seen on the bright sunny morning of my marriage to Frank Randall. "No," I exclaimed, "not here. I can't."
"Hisht now, hisht. Dinna worry, lass, dinna worry. It'll be all right."
Dougal put a large paw on my shoulder, making soothing Scottish noises, as if I were a skittish horse.
"'Tis natural to be a bit nervous," he said, to all of us.
A firm hand in the small of my back urged me on up the path. My shoes sank moistly in the damp layer of fallen leaves. Jamie and Dougal walked close on either side of me, preventing escape. Their looming plaid presences were unnerving, and I felt a mounting sense of hysteria. 200 years ahead, more or less, I had been married in this chapel, charmed then by its ancient picturesqueness. The chapel now was creaking with newness, its boards not yet settled into charm, and I was about to marry a 23-year-old Scottish Catholic virgin with a price on his head who's... I turned to Jamie in sudden panic. "I can't marry you. I don't even know your last name." He looked down at me and cocked a ruddy eyebrow.
"Oh, it's Fraser. James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser."
He pronounced it formally, each name slow and distinct. Completely flustered, I said, "Claire Elizabeth Beecham," and stuck out my hand idiotically. Apparently taking this as a plea for support, he took the hand and tucked it firmly into the crook of his elbow. Thus, inescapably pinioned, I squelched up the path to my wedding. Rupert and Murta were waiting for us in the chapel, keeping guard over a captive cleric, a spindly young priest with a red nose and a justifiably terrified expression. Rupert was idly slicing a willow twig with a large knife, and while he had laid aside his horn-handled pistols on entering the church, they remained in easy reach on the rim of the baptismal font. The other men also disarmed, as was suitable in the house of God, leaving an impressively bristling pile of lethality in the back pew. Only Jamie kept his dagger and sword, presumably as a ceremonial part of his dress. We knelt before the wooden altar. Murta and Dougal took their places as witnesses, and the ceremony began. The form of the Catholic marriage service hasn't changed appreciably in several hundred years, and the words linking me with a red-headed young stranger at my side were much the same as those that had consecrated my wedding to Frank. I felt like a cold, hollow shell. The young priest's stammering words echoed somewhere in the empty pit of my stomach. I stood automatically when it came time for the vows, watching in a sort of numbed fascination as my chilly fingers disappeared into my bridegroom's substantial grasp. His fingers were as cold as my own, and it occurred to me for the first time that despite his outwardly cool demeanour, he might be as nervous as I was. I had so far avoided looking at him, but now glanced up to find him staring down at me. His face was white and carefully expressionless. He looked as he had when I dressed the wound in his shoulder. I tried to smile at him, but the corners of my mouth wobbled precariously. The pressure of his fingers on mine increased. I had the impression that we were holding each other up. If either of us let go or looked away, we would both fall down. Oddly, the feeling was mildly reassuring. Whatever we were in for, at least there were two of us.
"I take thee, Claire, to be my wife."
His voice didn't shake, but his hand did. I tightened my grip. Our stiff fingers clenched together like boards in a vice.
"To love, honour and protect, for better and for worse."
The words came from far away. The blood was draining from my head. The boned bodice was infernally tight, and though I felt cold, sweat ran down my sides beneath the satin. I hoped I wouldn't faint. There was a small stained glass window set high in the wall at the side of the sanctuary, a crude rendering of John the Baptist in his bearskin. Green and blue shadows flowed over my sleeve, reminding me of the tavern's public room, and I wished fervently for a drink. My turn. I stuttered slightly, to my fury.
I take thee, James.
I stiffened my spine. Jamie had got through his half creditably enough. I could try to do as well.
To have and to hold from this day forth.
My voice came stronger now.
Till death us do part.
The words rang out in the quiet chapel with a startling finality. Everything was still, as though in suspended animation. Then the priest asked for the ring. There was a sudden stir of agitation, and I caught a glimpse of Murta's stricken face. I barely registered the fact that someone had forgotten to provide for the ring when Jamie released my hand long enough to twist a ring from his own finger. I still wore Frank's ring on my left hand. The fingers of my right looked frozen, pallid and stiff in a pool of blue light as the large metal circlet passed over the fourth finger. It hung loose on the digit and would have slid off had Jamie not folded my fingers around it and enclosed my fist once more in his own. More mumbling from the priest, and Jamie bent to kiss me. It was clear that he intended only a brief and ceremonial touching of lips. But his mouth was soft and warm, and I moved instinctively toward him. I was vaguely conscious of noises, Scottish whoops of enthusiasm and encouragement from the spectators, but really noticed nothing beyond the enfolding warm solidness. Sanctuary. We drew apart, both a little steadier, and smiled nervously. I saw Dougal draw Jamie's dirk from its sheath, and wondered why. Still looking at me, Jamie held out his right hand, palm up. I gasped as the point of the dirk scored deeply across his wrist, leaving a dark line of welling blood. There wasn't time to jerk away before my own hand was seized, and I felt the burning slice of the blade. Swiftly, Dougal pressed my wrist to Jamie's and bound the two together with a strip of white linen. I must have swayed a bit, because Jamie gripped my elbow with his free left hand.
"Bear up, lass," he urged softly. "It's not long now. Say the words after me."
It was a short bit of Gaelic, 2 or 3 sentences. The words meant nothing to me. But I obediently repeated them after Jamie, stumbling on the slippery vowels.